Good morning. Tomorrow is, as we know, Memorial Day, a day that many of us look forward to as a day off of work, from work. I was wondering how many people would be here on Memorial Day weekend. And in fact, I had a dream about this a couple of nights ago. I dreamed that there were three individuals and a family of five in the congregation. And when I stood up to preach, the family of five left. So if any of you are feeling like you'd like to leave, well, this would be the time. We are also aware that tomorrow is also a day for remembering the dead. I looked up the origins of Memorial Day on the History Channel website. And it says, Memorial Day honors the men and women who have died while serving in the U.S. military. It originated in the years following the Civil War. The Civil War claimed more lives than any other war in U.S. history. And it required the establishment of the country's first national cemeteries. On May 5, 1862, General John A. Logan, leader of an organization for Northern Civil War veterans, called for a nationwide day of remembrance. He proclaimed, "The 30th of May, 1868, is designated for the purpose of strewing with flowers or otherwise decorating the graves of comrades who died in defense of their country during the late rebellion, and whose bodies now lie in almost every city, village, and hamlet churchyard in the land." The date of Decoration Day, as he called it, was chosen because it wasn't the anniversary of any particular battle. On the first Decoration Day, General James Garfield made a speech at Arlington National Cemetery, and 5,000 participants decorated the graves of the 20,000 Union and Confederate soldiers buried there. Memorial Day, as Decoration Day gradually came to be known, originally honored only those lost while fighting in the Civil War. But during World War I, the United States found itself embroiled in another major conflict, and the holiday evolved to commemorate American military personnel who died in all wars. Whatever our feelings, thoughts, or beliefs about war are, the losses they have brought about and continue to bring about all over the world are truly staggering and truly sad. We acknowledge and mourn those deaths. I was familiar with Memorial Day from a very early age, not because any members of my family had been killed in war, but because my sister, who would have been several years older than me, had died shortly after her birth. Every Memorial Day, we laid flowers on her grave in the little cemetery outside of my hometown of Eads, Colorado. I imagined her tiny coffin and wondered that my big sister would always remain a baby. I may have ruminated on death more than the average child, not only because of that little headstone amid the sagebrush and tumbleweeds of the eastern Colorado plains, but also because of my mother, who was ill with emphysema and bronchiectasis for years before she died the July when I was 12. I suppose it's not too surprising that I ended up a hospital chaplain, well acquainted with death and dying. I suspect that a number of you are also well acquainted with death and dying. I guess it's sort of a club that no one wants to be a member of, but that we all end up joining at some point. I wonder about death, and the older I get, the more I wonder. I work with chaplain residents and interns in a program I run at St. Luke's Medical Center called CPE, or Clinical Pastoral Education. My students come with many different beliefs and different ways of understanding life and death. Some of them come into the program with a very clear vision of what they understand as life after death. And while they very well may leave CPE with the same beliefs they arrived with, they will also have had many opportunities to wonder about others' beliefs and understandings of what may happen after death, because they will have been providing spiritual care with dying patients, their families, and the staff who care for them. And they will also have had conversations with their peers and colleagues about their beliefs. I personally believe that I will either experience something after death, or I will experience nothing after death. And both of those possibilities are all right with me. I remember several students who have been quite upset by that, because the promise of heaven is central to their faith. One said to me, "If I thought there was no heaven, I would have no reason to live." That saddened me, and yet I think I get it on some level. It is one way of understanding the promise of resurrection from the Christian gospel, and it brings great comfort to many. For some, faith is the absolute assurance of who God is and what God does. For me, faith is actually the antithesis of knowing. If I already know, what need would I have for faith? Faith to me is trust in the spirit of love without the knowledge of exactly what that means or what to expect of it. I believe that having faith means embracing the powerlessness of being a human being in the past, the present, and the future, but especially in the present. I imagine that most people who have experienced serious illness or the death of a loved one, and this no doubt includes many people in this room, have felt that sock-in-the-gut sensation of powerlessness and struggled to make sense of it or learn how to live with it. I know I have, through my mother's illness and death, and also through my own illness 18 years ago when I developed blood clots in both my lungs. Both of these events have certainly altered the way I understand life. I think I'm more of a worrier than I might have been, wondering when or if something else will go haywire in my body, or someone I love will get ill or die. On the positive side, I've developed a greater understanding of my humanity, of the reality of my power and my powerlessness, of the importance of having integrity in my relationships while I can. Coming back to the readings for today, I'm particularly touched by Mary Oliver's ways of remembering and memorializing her relationship with her partner, Molly Malone Cook. I lived in Provincetown, Massachusetts, on the tip of Cape Cod in the 80s, and occasionally saw both Mary and Molly, though I didn't know them. I would note, though, that Mary came to my yard sale when I was getting ready to leave Provincetown, and she looked through all my books, but alas, she didn't go home with any of them. In my time on Cape Cod, I don't think very many people knew Mary. She was understood to be very private and reclusive. So Thirst, this intimate book of poems about her grief when Molly died, I think marks a major change in her life, not only because of her loss, but because of how she has chosen to mark that loss and move through it. When Molly died in 2005 at the age of 80, Mary, 10 years younger, looked for a way to live through her bereavement. In addition to writing the book Thirst, which was published in 2006, she spent a year going through thousands of Molly's photographs and unprinted negatives and combining them with her own reflections to create a book entitled Our World. In it, Mary wrote, "Though you have known someone for more than 40 years, though you have worked with them and lived with them, you do not know everything. I do not know everything, but a few things which I will tell." At the end of the book, after sharing some of what she knew about Molly, Mary concludes with this. The whistler. All of a sudden, she began to whistle. By all of a sudden, I mean that for more than 30 years, she had not whistled. It was thrilling. At first, I wondered, who was in the house? What stranger? I was upstairs reading, and she was downstairs. As from the throat of a wild and cheerful bird, not caught, but visiting. The sounds warbled and slid and doubled back and larked and soared. Finally, I said, "Is that you? Is that you whistling?" "Yes," she said. "I used to whistle a long time ago. Now I see I can still whistle." And cadence after cadence, she strolled through the house whistling. I know her so well, I think. I thought. Elbow and ankle, mood and desire, anguish and frolic, anger too. And the devotions. And for all that, do we even begin to know each other? Who is this I've been living with for 30 years? This clear, dark, lovely whistler. This brings me back to an earlier comment I made about faith. I believe faith has little, if anything, to do with knowledge. For me, faith is composed of trust and surprise and imagination. What a delight it must have been for Mary to discover that this woman she had loved intimately for half her lifetime could whistle like that. I wonder what surprises are in store for us, both in this life and in death. In writing this sermon, I did some research on Mary Oliver and Molly Malone Cook. And I found part of an interview from the March 2011 issue of O Magazine between Maria Shriver and Mary Oliver. In it, she talks about death, dying, and remembering. She was powerless in the humanity of Molly's illness and death, and in her deep grief and loneliness. She did, however, have power in how she chose to continue her life after this great loss. And I'd like to close by sharing an excerpt of that interview with you. Maria Shriver, you have lived a very unique life, a life really individual and fearless. Mary Oliver, well, it was never a temptation to be swayed from what I wanted to do and how I wanted to live. Even when Molly got ill, I knew what to do. They wanted to take her off to a nursing home, and I said, absolutely not. I took her home. That kind of thing is not easy. I used to go out at night with a flashlight and sit on a little bench right outside the house to scribble poems because I was too busy taking care of her during the day to walk in the woods. Maria Shriver, you had a 40-year relationship with Molly. How did her death change your life? Mary Oliver, I was very, very lonely. Maria, you've written in your work that you rarely spent any time apart. How did you avoid being crushed by losing her? Mary, I had decided I would do one of two things when she died. I would buy a little cabin in the woods and go inside with all my books and shut the door. Or I would unlock all the doors. We had always kept them locked. Molly liked that sense of safety. And see who I could meet in the world. And that's what I did. I haven't locked the door for 5 years. I have wonderful new friends, and I have more time to be by myself. It was a very steadfast, loving relationship, but often there is a dominant partner, and I was very quiet for 40 years, just happy doing my work. I'm different now. May we all have the courage to unlock our doors and embrace the surprises that await us. I invite you now to take a moment of silence to reflect on these words.